Thank you. I have heard of Holden Village with the hearing of the ears, and now mine eye seeth. And I'm not disappointed. Over the years, I've met many people, very good people, coming out of this community, and I'm deeply impressed by the work that is going on here. And if I said to Walter that I accepted this invitation at a weak moment, it had nothing to do with not wanting to come here. Of course, I wanted to do that. But it happens that I also have a job. Now, before I begin this little series of three lectures, or I would rather call them, I think, theological meditations, the crisis and the cross, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what lies behind them. First of all, they were inspired in part by the 500th anniversary of the European discovery of this part of the world by Columbus, and with that memory, also the memory of other European adventurers, Leif Erikson very early, an almost a mythic figure, John Cabot, whose real name, you know, was Giovanni Caboto, and our own Jacques Cartier, who came to my city of Montreal in the year 1534, and the first musical concert was given in Montreal in 1535, that is, music in the European mode, in what was then the village of Hochelaga, a Mohawk village, on which now my university is ensconced. Secondly, these talks are inspired by the memory of ordinary Europeans who were the first white settlers on these shores. I want to say that I identify strongly with those people. My own earliest European ancestors arrived in Connecticut around 1632 from Wales, and later on a number of them came from England, Scotland, and Ireland, but I'm not totally WASP, and that leads to the third inspiration for these talks. It happened that some of my people, being Mohawk, were here to welcome the boats of the Europeans. And in the wake of last year's shame in my own province of Quebec, at Oka, with the armies of my country massed against the Mohawks, I ask myself, as many of you ask about your treatment of your native peoples, at what cost we have built for half a millennium this society called North America. And finally, these meditations, which are partly, as you will see, an exercise in critical theology, are inspired by the hope, which I take to be Christian, that through new efforts at understanding what we have become, we may become better than we are, and even perhaps better than we first dreamt we would be. North America is not only a continent, one of the seven greater land masses of the planet Earth. It's also an idea. Its physical properties, including its vastness, its natural resources, its weather conditions, its great lakes and rivers, its productive plains, its mineral-rich rock and sweeping seacoasts, these are not incidental to the idea called America. Without all of these material properties, the American dream, with its pale Canadian version, could never have achieved prominence. These natural resources provided the raw materials for this magnificent conception of human existence, apart from their bounty, the idea of America would have remained at the level of pure utopianism. As you know, the word utopia means literally no place, utopos. There needed to be a place for the idea to take root. And to match the high expectations of such an idea, it had to be a very special place indeed, virtually a land flowing with milk and honey. But it would be impossible to comprehend the mystery of America if one considered only the physical properties of our continent, impressive as they may be. The essence of the New World cannot be seen. One cannot capture the meaning of America with a camera. Not today, as the protagonist in a German film entitled Alice in der Städten, Alice in the Cities, tried to do some years ago. And not in former times either, when America was still quite unambiguously America the Beautiful. Because the essence of North America is the idea which lies behind it. If you understand something of the idea, then you can see it manifested even in the physical realities of North America. In the cities, in the factories and stores, in the suburbs and villages, in the automobiles, in the farm machinery, also in every television commercial. And today, if you know something about that original informing idea, you can comprehend very much about North America, of the sort of thing that sickened the photographer of Alice in the Cities, including the violence and ugliness of so much in our cities and along our highways, the boredom and narcissism of many of our contemporaries, the strained faces of people in the streets. That, too, comes from the same ideational source. It reflects the situation of a people which has lost hold of its foundational idea, what Ernest Becker called its creative illusion. A people which therefore lacks an operative reason to be, a disillusioned people. With his camera, the clever photographer can capture some of the consequences, both of the illusion, the dream, and the disillusionment. But I think that to understand America, you have to become another kind of craftsman altogether. You have to search out the foundational idea and trace its evolution and follow its destiny. And that is not easy. I do not mean that the difficulty of such research is simply the usual difficulty of tracing the genesis of worldviews, although it is also that. I mean that the search for the foundational idea of America and the attempt to trace this idea through to its present and impending manifestations is a painful undertaking in the existential sense. Because the idea that is the essence of America is deeply implanted in the consciousness of all modern people. Thus, to search out its origins and to follow its destiny through to the present and the impending future means to engage in an act of self-analysis at the same time. For America is the dream of modern Homo sapiens. When you ask about the idea called America, you are asking about the whole modern experiment. And modernity in our time has assumed crisis proportions. But more of that later. We can only comprehend the crisis if we first reflect upon the vision, the inspiration, the dream, the creative illusion, or as I'm calling it here simply, the idea, which is the presupposition of this crisis. As such, that idea preceded the awareness that there might indeed be a place where such a conception of life could achieve a foothold in history. It's surely one of the great marvels of world history that the European discovery of America coincided so closely with the elaboration of a new image of humanity, a new imago hominis, so apparently suitable to that place. One must, of course, add at once that the coincidence in question is not entirely without a rationale. Because if Cartier and Cabot and Columbus and the other daring explorers were inspired to sail off into the deep unknown, it was at least in part because their imaginations had been sparked precisely by that new image of the human in its early stages. Man the explorer, and I use the masculine form here intentionally, man the explorer, man the measurer of the world. This was very much at the core of this new imago hominis. All the same, there is an element of great mystery in this coincidence of idea and place. For while the atmosphere of the early Renaissance may indeed have given rise to such adventurers and such measurers of the earth, there was nothing to guarantee that they would in fact stumble upon such a place. It was, as you all know, the place that they found was not the place for which they were looking. Since most of the explorers were in the employ of princes, the appropriateness of their discovery was not immediately perceived. For princes are not given to radical dreams. Like princes everywhere, the Renaissance sovereigns who financed these fantastic voyages only wanted more of what they already had. They were anxious, therefore, to find a more convenient path to the riches of the Orient. When instead of India and the Far East, the explorers found America, there was considerable disappointment in the palaces of Europe. For a long time, America could be made acceptable to the ruling classes of Europe only by becoming the provider of luxury items for the rich. My own country, and more especially my own city of Montreal, has its economic origins in that kind of greed, the fur trade. But while the princes and the aristocracy grew fat and careless in their beaver hats and their mink robes, the intellectuals of Europe dreamt on. They dreamt of man in terms of freedom and the mastery of earth. They foresaw the measurer and explorer of nature becoming nature's lord and possessor, maître et possesseur, Descartes. Eventually, their dream, in various forms, would topple most of the princes or reduce them to ornaments of state. And it would find for itself its most natural habitat in precisely that continent to which the aristocrats of Europe looked only for furs and curious stories of primitive peoples, Indians, as the explorers in their haste had named the native persons of America. It was America, and not the Orient, and not old Europe either, which would provide the stage for the new drama of enlightened humanity, the place for the idea. For one thing, it was a virtually empty stage. In Europe, particularly in Germany, and particularly, I think, on account of Karl May, much is made of the North American Indians in the lore of our continent. But in fact, they were few in number, given the enormous size of the land. Moreover, they were, for the most part, non-aggressive, divided into many tribes and bands, and content with their own nomadic form of society. It did not take long for the enterprising Europeans to discover how easy it was to take from such peoples a land which, in their innocency, the so-called Indians never imagined themselves to possess in the first place, the idea of possession being still relatively foreign to them, and especially the possession of land. Thus, the availability of the place, together with its rich resources, made the continent of North America a veritable home for the new humanity outlined by the intellectuals of Europe. America would be the new world for the new man, or as Sidney Mead said, the new Eden for the new Adam. As I've already suggested, the correlation of idea and place was only gradually realized. Moreover, its realization already involved a certain amount of simplification and compromise, as the incarnation of ideas normally does. Certainly, we do not have here an immediate transfer of idea to place. History doesn't work that way. What we have, rather, is the gradual unfolding of a new image of the human by a handful of intellectuals and dreamers, and then aspects of the new image are expressed in organizational and institutional forms, and negatively, in the dissatisfaction of numbers of people with their lot. And then, over a long period of time, salient features of the new image of the human push aside old assumptions and mores and values and become the new presuppositions of the dominant culture. In the case of the idea that generated America, it was not the intellectuals themselves who engineered this new enterprise. Far from it. Most of them did not even see any great future for this new world. Voltaire, whose ideas certainly did influence the American dream, considered New France, as my country was then called, a few acres of snow. Many others remembered that Jacques Cartier had written in his log when he first gazed upon the rocky coasts of Labrador in 1534, he wrote, "Surely this is the land that God gave to Cain." The working out of the idea was rather through more indirect means and through persons who were by no means intellectuals. Concretely, that means the so-called colonizers, who were the early equivalents of today's developers, and the colonists or settlers themselves. The colonizers were entrepreneurs, motivated by personal gain, although some of them were idealists of a sort. It was they who first created the popular picture of America as the land of unlimited opportunity, unbegrenzten Möglichkeiten. But, of course, that concept would never have had any positive appeal if the idea had not also made its way into the general consciousness of European civilization, namely the idea that human beings could better their lot, that they did not have to sit and wait for the plague or the potato famine to take their lives, that they did not have to spend their days serving other, more powerful people, that they could take their destinies into their own hands, make a new start, turn over a new leaf in a new world. As for the settlers themselves, most of them were untutored folk, peasants, soldiers and ex-soldiers, and later on refugees from the turmoils of a Europe in the throes of industrial revolution. Certainly these simple folk, whom I think of as the third world of their day, had not read the philosophers of the Renaissance or the Enlightenment. They did not lace their ordinary speech with high-flown terms like autonomy and mastery. Most of them did not know the phrase the rights of man. Nevertheless, if you read about them, if you read their own simple prose in letters and diaries kept by the most literate, you will realize that the vision of existence that lay behind such philosophic language was in the air, and that it was what gave power to their muscles as they tackled the enormous work of clearing the continent. If you had asked them why they labored so long, what gave them the courage to face those hardships, they would probably, most of them, have answered in the language of religious faith. But beneath this language, if you were perceptive, you would have heard ideas very different from the religious traditions out of which they had in fact come, different from the theological conventions of the medieval world, different also from the pietistic doctrines which many of them had imbibed in simple forms. What you would have heard behind the homely religious language of their hymns and prayers and poems was precisely that new humanism which was the stuff of the modern vision. They felt themselves to be creating a society in which they themselves, and not some earthly or perhaps heavenly overlord, would play the decisive role. It could be observed immediately, of course, that part of the perennial problem of America, as for example Alexis de Tocqueville observed it in the early 1800s, stems precisely from this fact, namely the fact that in the process of its realization, the foundational idea of the New World was reduced to a simplistic version of itself, of the original. When people like developers and the working classes take hold of concepts dreamt up in the studies of great intellectuals, they tend to eliminate from those concepts their nuances, their qualifications, their provisos, perhaps also their flexibility. I suppose one has a similar situation with the contemporary practical applications of the thought of that man who sat in the British Museum day after day and thought up a new vision of society, one Karl Marx. One must frankly admit, I think, that a dimension of the problematic of North America is indeed to be found here, namely, in the reduction of the modern vision to truncated versions of its more sophisticated expressions. That, however, is by no means a full explanation of the problematic in question. Moreover, on the positive side of that same coin, it should be noted that the very simplicity or relative simplicity of those who peopled North America constituted an advantage. Precisely because the vast majority of those in whom the modern vision was realized in the American situation were not intellectuals or highly educated persons, the dominant features of that vision were able to find a real foothold in their minds and spirits. If it had been left for the intellectuals to populate and organize the American continent, we should be waiting still. For what we normally mean by education, as many contemporary critics of educational systems have pointed out, is in a basic way indoctrination into the fundamental values of the dominant culture of a given society. Just because the North American pioneers were not so thoroughly indoctrinated into the values of their old European princedoms and empires, they were able to reach out in greater faith toward the new vision. After all, they were not the ones who benefited from the value systems of those older societies. They were, in fact, its victims, most of them. So that neither by education nor by inclination were they so welded to the old that they could not wholly let it go, as most of the intellectuals who invented the new vision were still personally welded to the old. It is, for example, impossible and ludicrous to picture a man like Voltaire living, say, in Savannah, Georgia, in the early decades of the 18th century. Even that Oxford don, John Wesley, just barely survived this exposure to the new world, although he was certainly a more adaptable person than the urbane Voltaire. Besides, there were in many of these early immigrants conscious determinations to have done with that old world. The tale that is still told in my family of my own Hall ancestor is instructive. It's almost parabolic, it seems to me. When he left Northern Ireland around the year 1830, it is said, his mother came to the ship bearing the family Bible. He was the only son and heir, and he should therefore take with him to the new life this great treasure, a treasure symbolizing not only the stark values of Irish Protestantism, but also containing the records of the family. Well, when he got safely out to sea, he pitched it overboard. It was not, I think, an act of cynicism or sacrilege. It was a faith in the new. Evidently, my ancestor felt that the future of the new world was not only independent of the old, but that it required a spirit ready to chuck out the old in order to get on with the new. It was this same sentiment, I think, that inspired that plain man, Henry Ford, a century later on, to utter the classic line, "History is mostly bunk." While it is true, then, that the new vision which inspired America was a simple version of the original form, it's also true that it could find a real place in the hearts of these settlers, a place almost unrivaled by other worldviews. What one had then, by way of a place for the new idea, was not only an almost unoccupied continent, almost, but an almost unpreoccupied people, the disenfranchised and the poor and the rejects of the old world, who were pure enough in spirit to believe the vision of a brave new world. And even if their purity was tainted, they were smart enough to realize that their lot in that new world, for all of its pain and hardship, was a darn sight better, as the colloquial turn of phrase had it, than the prospects of continuing to eke out an existence in crowded, class-conscious, fate-ridden old Europe. It's for this reason that the modern vision must be associated with America in particular, even though it originated in Europe, and even though it belongs in some real sense to the whole world. Certainly the architects of that vision, the philosophers and artists of the Renaissance and its aftermath, never regarded their dream as being applicable only to North American society. They dreamt for humanity at large. And we know that every major kingdom in Europe was greatly influenced by that dream. France, dramatically. England, early and with, as one would expect, a more reasonable evolution. Germany, perhaps tragically, but in the long run, perhaps with greater single-mindedness than anywhere else in Europe. Russia, violently and late in time. The modern vision of man and his world, terre des hommes, did not and does not acknowledge boundaries. It was and is limitless in its applicability. And yet North America presents in this regard a special case. For on this vast continent, relatively free from national rivalries, free, it was believed, from the sins of the fathers, and on the positive side, filled with so many good things, here it was possible for humanity to feel that it was making a brand new start. Here, therefore, the idea could be tested more fully than in the older cultures of Europe where it first unfolded. In North America, one had almost a natural and historical carte blanche, part of which was the very openness of the minds and hearts of those settlers who left old Europe with nothing to lose and entered the new world with a sense of almost innocent expectancy. Here, the modern European dream has been allowed to root itself. It has been given time. It has been given resources. It has been given peaceful conditions with only a few interruptions. It has been given, above all, a beliefful people. And it has been permitted to develop now for 3 or 4 centuries. And what may we say of it after this long experience? What is the status of our creative illusion of modernity's dream, American style? What are its prospects for the future? Well, we know how such questions as these are being answered by a significant and ever vocal portion of the population of North America today. The incipient self-doubt of the 1960s and early 70s, engendered by the war in Southeast Asia, by the crisis of institutions, by the first signs of the crisis of the natural environment, this is all dismissed and set aside with a flourish by the segment of the population that I have in mind. In its place, one hears new and vigorous pronouncements about the glorious past and future of this society. In both the United States and Canada, governments are elected on slogans that are lifted straight out of the age of progress without any embarrassment. We're told the old myths of our greatness and our innocency in ever more callous forms, and many of us believe them still. The Persian Gulf War seems to have renewed for many, many, the myth at least of our greatness, and even for the unsuspecting of our innocency. Moreover, as Christians, we notice that some of the most enthusiastic support for this resolve to make America great again comes from fellow Christians who are apparently able to see in this determination to reinstate the dream the unfolding of their own avowedly Christian aims. But even if the dream could be revitalized, a thing which in itself would require a spiritual turning back of the clock that can only be envisaged by the very innocent. Its achievement could only come at an enormous cost. The cost to which I'm referring is not merely the necessity for belt tightening and the cutting of waste that the administrations of both of our countries like to speak about now. By cost, I mean the kind of thing that is reflected in the budgets of our nations and in the deliberate abandonment of humanitarian projects in favor of taxation measures that will serve the few who can exemplify once more the dream understood in consumer society terms. What again and again is brought home to sensitive observers of our context is that the revitalization of the dream for some, a privileged few, must mean its diminution for many others, even in our own midst. But as a Christian and as one who is conscious of both European and Third World opinions of the activities of our continent, the cost that concerns me more than such internal consequences is the global impact of our newly militant determination to regain and sustain our way of life. There is, I think, a fierce logic in all of this. If the dream is to be revived and revitalized, it can only be done through the enactment of foreign policies which are hazardous to world peace and oblivious to the humane and Christian concerns for justice. The reason is simple enough. There just isn't enough pie to go around. Not that kind of pie. So long as one could assume that the poor people of India and South Africa or El Salvador would be content with their lot, perhaps with the help of that opiate that Marx named religion, so long as we could assume that, it was possible to dream the American dream in relative calm and even to invite to these shores such of Earth's wretched as could find their way to us. But a great many external and internal factors, amongst them the externally visible success of the American story, have encouraged people all over the world to dream the impossible dream. In the People's Republic of China, they do not call it, of course, the American dream, even though it is now replete with Coca-Cola and pizza. And in Zimbabwe, still another rhetoric is used. But it's the same dream, nevertheless, with variations on the theme. For 75 years, every school child in the Soviet bloc memorized the rudiments of what is in fact a close cousin of the American dream. For they're all of them variations on the theme that life could be beautiful here and now, that very good pie can be had right now, not later on, in the sky when you die. Everyone except the few critics of modernity who seem to the majority like grim malcontents, covets the material prosperity, the technological prowess, the death-defying medicines and surgical technologies, and all the other great and good things that have been acquired through human mastery and rationality, inspired by the aggressive, progressive spirit of modernity. But the earth will not sustain these multitudinous desires. There are limits to growth. If everyone in the world were to covet and to seek to acquire even half the things taken for granted by the average North American middle-class household, the earth would collapse under the weight of its human burden. Nature, already groaning in travail on account of human greed and waste, would rebel utterly. The rebellion is already in the offing. What this means is that the dream, the idea by which this continent has been fashioned can only be entertained seriously from now on by surrounding it with defenses. Whether it is dreamt in the United States or France or West Germany or South Africa, it must now be fortified by military and economic and nationalistic policies which will protect its host's society from all the others who desire the same good things. There is thus, as I've said, a fierce, a frightening logic between the political rhetorical insistence that the American dream in all of its fullness can be brought back and the kind of military budgets and economic policies that we are witnessing in the two northern countries of this favored continent, the recent much heralded cuts in military spending notwithstanding. It is a great irony, but nonetheless true, that a social dream which once could inspire the humanitarian rhetoric of the greatest 18th and 19th century intellectuals as they contemplated the peaceable kingdom that was being fashioned in this place, that this has now become in our own time the inspiration for retaining the sort of military hardware which could in fact destroy, perhaps, the whole civilized world. This logic alone ought to be sufficient to make us wonder whether the fault lies elsewhere. Those who want to revitalize the dream assume, it is their basic assumption, that the failure of the dream is due to social or economic or geopolitical factors at work in the contemporary scene. For the repressive amongst our populations, this means the activity of some external enemy, communism or socialism or big government or the irrationalities of fundamentalist Islam and so forth. For the less paranoid amongst us, it means some failure within our own collective spirit. We have failed the dream. We have not been sufficiently believing or diligent or dedicated. We have loved ease too much. We have not seriously pursued our democratic responsibilities. We have retreated into private worlds and have left the public realm to the worst elements, and so forth, and so forth. And many of these things may indeed be true. But what if, in addition to, or before all such considerations, one were to ask whether the fault might not lie with the dream itself? Was it perhaps the wrong dream, the wrong idea? Or if it was not wrong earlier, might it now be wrong, wrong for us? And what could we, the North Americans, who have so long dreamt this dream and with such total effect, what would we say about it? Not only about its results, but about its presuppositions. If we began asking ourselves at this juncture in our historical pilgrimage whether the dream itself hadn't had from the outset certain inherent flaws. What I'm suggesting, and I do so quite specifically out of Christian conviction and for the sake of responsible stewardship of God's beloved world, what I'm suggesting is that instead of joining with those who, with certain of our population and leadership, seek to reinstate in a technologized manner the vision upon which this society was founded, we might at this point in time more profitably subject our foundational vision to a new and critical scrutiny. It need not be our aim, it should not be our aim, simply to cast aspersion on the founders of our society or in any way to damn the past. That's cheap. We must ask about the idea that gave us our self-image, and we must ask about it critically, because it may be, it just may be, that whatever good this idea may have inspired in the past and may still in some ways inspire, it is today a fundamentally misleading vision, one which may lead to a good deal of disaster. The promise of the dream that was fashioned out of this idea was that it would, if pursued with diligence, bring about happiness. But I cannot hear that word now without recalling the late assertion of the great German scientist theologian Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, who said with much clarity of mind, "A society based on the pursuit of happiness cannot survive. Only a society based on the pursuit of truth can survive." When happiness in contemporary North America has to be defended by weapons that could kill everybody many times over, and economic and foreign policies that guarantee the continued unhappiness and poverty of millions, then what on earth does happiness mean? Whom does it profit, even if it can be attained? And are we, in fact, happy? Christians in the past, and still today, have put their not inconsiderable weight behind the fabrication of this dream of human prosperity and happiness. But I wonder, was that dream ever wholly consistent with the gospel of the manger and the cross? What had to be eliminated from the gospel in order for the church to buy into the modern vision? Did perhaps truth itself have to be set aside in part? The truth that this is a limited world and that we are creatures, not gods, not masters. The truth that personal and national happiness, when pursued as one's chief end, is usually acquired only at the expense of someone else. The truth that suffering is also part of the human condition and cannot readily be dispensed with, nay, may even strangely be necessary to our greatest good. I'm speaking to you as a child of this continent, a child of many generations of persons, male and female, who have tilled the soil of this continent and taught the young and fought the battles of our nations. But I'm made to wonder, precisely as a loyal North American, whether this might not, after all, have become the most problematic place in the world today. Because of the dream we dreamt, and because we want to dream it still unchanged by all that we might have learnt from our dreaming and experiencing of nearly half a millennium, something happened to me to make me question the foundational vision of my own culture, the vision that I read about, that I sang in the songs of World War II, for example, the vision that I imbibed from my youth up. Something happened to me to doubt the dream, to doubt the formative idea and ideal, the creative illusion. And I too became disillusioned. Something happened. And I suspect it may have been the gospel. Thank you.